Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the VGI Partners Limited 1H20 Results Briefing Conference Call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. For the phone parties, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. For the webcast viewers, to ask a question, please click on the Ask a Question tab on the top right-hand corner of your screen anytime during the conference. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Robert Luciano, Executive Chairman and Portfolio Manager. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and welcome to the first half 2020 results conference call and webcast for VGI Partners Limited. With me in the room is Ian Cameron, our CFO, David Jones, who is an Executive Director of VGI Partners, David Symons and Tom Davies, who are senior members of our investment team, and Ingrid Groer, who heads up our investor relations team. Now, the purpose of today is to take your questions on the half-year result that were lodged with the ASX this morning. But before we go to questions, I'd like to highlight some key points from our slide presentation, and Ian will talk through the detail of the financial result. Now, turning to page two. The first half of the calendar year was a challenging period due to the spread of COVID across the world. Equity indices fell sharply in the March quarter before rebounding strongly on the back of central bank and fiscal stimulus. Markets quickly priced in a reopening of economies and a return to business as usual for consumers. Our portfolios were resilient in the downturn of the first quarter, which is consistent with the central role of capital preservation as one of the three key tenets of our investment philosophy. However, our short positions and foreign exchange exposures in US dollars for our larger funds were headwinds for the portfolios in the second quarter of this year when markets rebounded. As a result, funds under management decreased by 7% in the half to finish the period at $2.9 billion. This decline is almost entirely attributable to performance. I note also there were no strategic initiatives undertaken during the half year, and our funds are closed to new investment. Those of you who were on the VG1 call last week would recall that I discussed some changes we made to our investment process and portfolios in June and July. Most importantly, the investment team is working extremely well together, and it's great to be working very closely with our senior analysts, Rob Poyner, Tom Davies, Marco Anselmi, and Andrew Chow, on the global and the Asian portfolios. I will now turn to our income statement. Total operating revenue for the half was $22 million. That was almost entirely due to management fees. Normalized costs were $8 million and down around 25% on the prior corresponding period. This resulted in normalized EBIT of $14 million and normalized NPAT of $9.9 million. Statutory NPAT was $3.6 million due to the impact of amortization of listed investment company IPO costs, combined with fair value movements in our long-term investments in VG1 and VG8 ordinary shares. Financial performance was well down on the same period last year, as performance fees were negligible for the half year. However, I should note that all funds under management are now either above their high water marks or within 4%. Therefore, we are well placed for a return to increased profitability if we generate performance in line with our objectives from here on in. The board has just declared an interim fully franked dividend of 5 cents per share. Now, moving to the next section. We've included a couple of slides here that describe our business and our strong focus on alignment of interests. In particular, as we note on page 6, our board, staff and their families have well over $100 million invested in our funds and also own over 77% of VGI Partners itself. We are closely aligned both with the investors in our funds and with the external shareholders in VGI Partners itself. Now turning to page 7. This chart shows the track record of the VGI Partners Master Fund, which is our longest established core fund. The portfolio has delivered compound annual returns of 13% since it was established in January 2009. This performance is within our target range of 10 to 15% per annum over the long term and through the investment cycle, and that return is net of all fees. It is also important to note that we have achieved this not just net of fees, but with an average net equity exposure of 69%, meaning that we've delivered returns that are superior to the market while holding a very substantial cash buffer. I would also highlight that since inception, the Master Fund portfolio has tended to outperform in periods of market weakness, and as you can see on the slide, in down market months when the index fell 2.4% on average, the Master Fund was only down 0.8%. At this point, I'd like to hand over to our CFO, Ian Cameron.
Thanks, Rob. Now turning to the financials on page 9. I would like to start by explaining a couple of normalisation adjustments to the firm's profits. These normalisations are similar to those that we described in our full-year result in February. Firstly, we have added back the amortisation costs of the IPOs of our two listed investment companies, VG1 and VG8. This adjustment affects the management fee line and was $2.5 million in the first half. This amortisation exists because VGI Partners, as the investment manager, paid for the offer costs of both IPOs, as well as issuing free alignment shares in VGI to participants in the VG8 IPO. The combined amount of these costs appear on the balance sheet under what we call contract assets. At its peak, this asset was around $50 million and is expected to amortise down to zero over roughly 10 years. As at 30 June, contract assets totaled $46.6 million. A second normalisation on this page is that we have added back unrealised fair value losses of $5.7 million pre-tax to the other income line. This relates to the mark-to-market impact of VGI's holdings in VG1 and VG8 shares, given the share prices of both of these listed investment companies fell during the period. The final normalisation that we have made to the table on page 9 is one that does not affect profits, but is the reclassification between lines on the income statement. The background here is that VGI Partners pays for the operating costs of its funds to the maximum extent permitted. We pay for $800,000 in fund operating costs in the first half. Now, due to recent changes in accounting standards for revenues, we are required to net these for management fees in our statutory accounts. However, in this table, we have reversed this change and instead included this amount in normalised operating costs. All normalisation adjustments were tax affected at 30%, aside from the cost of issuing VGI Partners alignment shares, which are not tax deductible and thus not tax affected. Slide 18 provides a full reconciliation of these adjustments and the calculation of earnings per share, or EPS. It is also important to note that our normalisations in the first half were non-cash items. The next couple of slides provide more detail on our revenues. Turning to page 10, the chart on the right-hand side of the page shows that funds under management have grown strongly since VGI Partners was established. In recent years, this growth has been assisted by positive investment performance and the launch of our two listed funds, VG1 and VG8. All of our funds are closed to net new investment. But as Rob mentioned earlier, funds under management decreased by 7% to $2.9 billion during the first half. Turning to page 11, management fees in the first half were materially higher than prior periods. This was due to higher average funds and our VG1 fee waiver ending in late April 2019. In other words, VGI Partners has been receiving management fees from VG1 since that date. In addition to management fees, we also earn performance fees of 15% across all our funds, subject to high watermarks. While performance fees in the first half were negligible, the slide shows that when the investment portfolios perform well, performance fees can make a very material contribution to revenue. As Rob noted earlier, as at the start of the week, all our funds are either above or within 4% of their high watermarks. Now turning to page 12, which provides more detail on expenses. Normalised operating costs, excluding depreciation and amortisation, were $7.8 million. This amount was down 25% on the first half 2019 due to a combination of lower staff bonuses and careful management of expenses. If VGI Partners earns material performance fees in the future, a high proportion of these will flow to the bottom line. Regarding other costs on this page, we also achieved some savings in research, communications and IT. This was mainly due to contract renegotiations and reduced travel due to COVID-19. Normalised costs were $800,000 higher than statutory because, as I mentioned earlier, the accounting rules require us to deduct the operating costs of the VGI's funds from revenue, but we have reclassified them as costs in our normalised earnings. Now turning to page 13 for the balance sheet. We finished the period with $41 million in cash and no debt. This was an increase of almost $12 million in the half. The increase reflects free cash flow of $21 million, partly offset by dividend payments of $6.5 million, and the purchase of VG1 and VG8 shares on market for $3 million. On this last point, our holdings in VG1 and VG8 appear on the balance sheet under financial assets. You can see that these were valued at $26 million at 30 June. The fall in value since December reflects the fact that while we purchased additional shares during the period, the share price of both listed investment companies declined. The other item on the balance sheet that I wanted to highlight are the contract assets of $47 million. As mentioned earlier, these represent the cost of VG1 and VG8 IPOs and will be amortised over the life of the VG1 and VG8 investment management agreements. Turning to the dividend, the board has declared a 5-cent per share interim dividend. This is fully franked at 27.5% and will be paid to all shareholders who are on the register at the record date of the 1st of September. The payment date is the 14th of September. The dividend translates to 97% of statutory profits and 36% of normalised profits. So it's below the company's target payout policy of 50 to 75% of normalised profits. On this occasion, the dividend has been constrained by the company's franking credit and retained earnings balances. I will now pass you back to Rob Luciano to discuss page 14.
Thank you, Ian. Now, I'm pleased to say that VGI Partners supports a number of charities and our total donation since VGI's formation in 2008 is currently running at approximately $6.4 million. This includes a recent $100,000 pledge to Mission Australia, which we chose to support given the hardship that many Australian families will experience as the economic impacts of COVID develop. I won't spend too much time on this slide, but it is worth noting that our donations include cash donations and fee rebates for funds that we manage for select charities and foundations. We also formed the VGI Partners Foundation in late 2018 and established a new charitable foundation class in our VGI Partners Master Fund. 100% of management and performance fees earned by VGI on the charitable foundation class are donated to the VGI Partners Foundation into perpetuity. So far, this has resulted in $800,000 of donations to date. More importantly, the charitable foundation class had around $26 million of funds under management at the end of June 2020, and this equates to roughly $400,000 of fee donations per annum purely from management fees. Now turning to page 15. On this slide, we have summarised our shareholder engagement program. As you can see, there are a number of events happening during the year. In particular, given the travel restrictions of COVID-19, our annual October roadshow will be virtual this year, and more details will be announced soon. I would encourage you to visit our website. Here you can find our investor letters, our briefings, and other materials. You can also subscribe for email communications on the Contact Us page if you're not currently on our distribution list. Now, if you have any questions about your holding or VGI Partners, please feel free to contact Ingrid in our investor relations team. So that brings us to the end of the presentation, and we'll now move to questions. Operator, we will start off by taking questions that have been submitted over the webcast before we go to the phones. Now, I've asked Tom Davies from our investment team to read out the questions from the webcast. Tom, over to you.
Thanks, Rob. We'll take questions from the webcast before checking the phone lines. The first question is, after a softer period of returns in the June quarter, you mentioned some changes to the investment process. Do you think these changes have contributed to improved portfolio performance in July and August?
Thanks, Tom. Softer returns in the June quarter is flattering. They were unacceptable returns in the June quarter. The changes that were made were really as follows. After a very long period of being long US dollars or short Australian dollars, which has been a long-standing position from roughly parity and highly additive to portfolio returns, Australian dollar portfolio returns, we made the belated decision to cut that position at roughly half of it at 68.69 cents, the other remaining balance at in between 70 and 71. So that was a key change in terms of our portfolio construction. Another key change was we substantially reduced short positions, which we started in May, but then continued through June, and really now have moved to a modest index short position. And I've discussed on a number of calls, we in this environment with ongoing central bank activity and federal or government activity in terms of fiscal support, we're finding it very difficult to implement fundamental short selling, particularly accounting-based capabilities. And in this environment, weak industry structures can masquerade under a variety of criteria. An example, you could have a weak industry structure or a weak business model, and you can very quickly pretend that you have an e-commerce capability, and all of a sudden your business model is no longer flawed and no longer has issues because of the masquerading. And that is happening in some cases to success in the share price in the short term. There's no doubt a variety of opportunities that we're watching and monitoring, but we're finding it very difficult to move towards wholesale single stock shorting. But our watch list is growing, and we are increasingly doing more work on opportunities, particularly industries that we think will be displaced over time as a consequence of what is taking place. I guess the other key point in terms of change is something that we started to do last year. We cut our position in Medibank, which was we outstayed our welcome. It was a position where we made a substantial return in a short period of time, and then I think outstayed our welcome, and so our compound return on that investment was handicapped. We've arguably done that a number of times, where we've found a good business, we've made money, and then we mistake a situation that has capped upside, and capped upside means a business that only has a certain sized addressable market or a certain sized revenue pool. Its margins can really only improve so much, its free cash flow can really only maximise so much, and therefore the valuation is largely limited. Imagine it as a block of units that's 100% leased, and there's only so much that is worth unless you adjust your cap rate. And
it's very much the same thing. So we need to be more cognizant and more cognizant of capped upside, more cognizant of not falling in love with our own ideas, and we've you know, moved towards a process that we've always had, which is questioning our views and questioning our analysis, but we've now reinstituted or reinvigorated that process, whereby I guess to use one of Charlie Munger's favourite comments is, you know, you want each day you want to try and kill or destroy your most cherished idea, and if you can't, it's been a good day. And that means that if you have an investment thesis or you have a large investment in something, you need to try and disprove the idea. You need to try and prove it wrong, and be unemotional about it and be objective about it. And if you can't disprove it, then it's proven to be a good investment and it stays in the portfolio for another day or another week or another year. But when you look for self-confirming evidence and you let your biases creep in and you let your arrogance creep in, and perhaps even more so, arrogance then coupled with ignorance is deadly in investments, then that becomes a problem. And so I think, like with any organisation and any process, you need to constantly improve. You know, the greatest businesses in the world constantly improve. And that's certainly the mantra of our largest investment, which we've had now for many years, which is Amazon. And, you know, to the credit of the founder there, he has a day one mentality. And I think that is one of the many secrets to his success and that corporation's success. So I'd say they're the evolutions and changes. Has that got something to do with the improved performance? Well, the improved performance is linked to markets continuing to go up, and a number of our stocks have performed well. Amazon has done well. MasterCard's done well. Some of our stocks have treaded water. But we also hold very high cash balances. We don't hold high cash balances because we're enamoured with holding cash. We just have found some opportunities, but prices have moved very quickly, very rapidly, and in some cases without too much reason. And the imputed levels of growth, not just for technology businesses, but really for all businesses, the imputed growth in current prices is quite elevated. And so, yes, interest rates are low. They're low in most countries due to suppression and implementation of policies by central banks. For instance, in Australia, the risk-free rate is capped at 25 points for the next 3 years. The US Federal Reserve is talking about yield curve control and has certainly said that it will keep the risk-free rate low for many years to come. And that has impacted asset prices. But the other thing that's impacted asset prices is the unprecedented, I'll try and use that word only once today, flood of money into the global system by central banks, the US Federal Reserve, the Bank of Japan, Reserve Bank of Australia, Central Bank of China, People's Republic of China. The flood of money has been without precedent, and it is making its way into the financial system, and it's making its way into the hands of consumers for now, and that is being reflected in asset prices and in some areas, in some pockets of consumption, elevated consumption. That's a as usual, a long-winded answer to what is a reasonably complex question. Talking about performance is not a straightforward answer. I don't know. Tom Davies is one of our senior investment analysts and has recently relocated from New York. Tom, do you have a view? And then I might ask Rob Poyner, who's on the phone from New York, his views as well. Tom, do you have a view?
In terms of process, I think one adjustment made is that the senior investment team are working more, senior analyst team are working more closely together. I think that's been very additive, and as Rob said, there's a lot of red teaming and a lot of counter thesis and testing ideas, which has really ramped up, I would say, or been brought back to the fore in the past few months. So I think that's been very additive over the last quarter.
Yeah, Rob? Rob Pointer. Yeah, no, I just add to that. I think, you know, the team is working more closely together than I can remember, you know, in many years. And one of the other things I just add is, you know, we took the chance to kind of step back and look at where we're concentrating our research process. And as part of that, you know, we've kind of identified a number of long-term thematics that we want to get exposure to and have the portfolio exposed to. And so, you know, another, you know, minor tweak we've made is really identifying the areas where we want to concentrate the research process, you know, over the next 6, 12, 24 months.
And I think the other point now is that I work directly now with, you know, the senior analyst team. You know, there's no one who interposes that. I'm directly involved with the team, with Tom, with Marco, with Rob Pointer, and with Andrew Chow. And then Andrew Chow works with Tom, Marco, and Rob Pointer. So it works quite well together. And that combination of working directly, dynamically, real time, is really back to where we were a number of years ago, and I think sort of morphs the role of you know, the head of research role has been really split and dissected between Rob Pointer, Tom Davies, Marco Anselmi, and Andrew Chow, and that is a very important evolution because it A, empowers those senior members, it B, allows for accelerated red teaming, which is taking the opposite side to a view, and it ensures that we have greater depth of coverage and understanding of coverage, and I think it limits our capacity. We'll still make mistakes. That is assured. That is guaranteed. We'll make mistakes. But I think that the probability of making errors where we don't try to kill our most cherished idea, I think that the probability of that has changed back into our favour.
Okay, so I think we'll go over to the webcast for a couple more questions. We've got one here. Please, could you explain the 27.5% franking as opposed to 30%?
I'll hand that over to Ian Cameron, our Chief Financial Officer.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you for the question. Companies that have turnover of less than $50 million pay tax at 27.5%. Follows that VGI's franking rate will be 27.5% until VGI's turnover exceeds $50 million. Note that as VGI's turnover was less than $50 million for the period ended 31 December 2019, which coincided with a change of tax year end, the company will only be able to frank dividends paid in the 2020 calendar year at 27.5%.
Sorry. Thank you. We'll go to the next question. So, cash donations of $1.3 million represent a high 36% of statutory profit. Can you outline expectations for cash donations going forward? And the second part of that question is, can you please outline what you expect to do with the increased cash holding of $41 million at June 30? Many thanks.
Okay. Look, I'll hand that one over to Ian Cameron, but the changes that we have made is that we now make the majority of our donations through the VGI Partners Foundation. I believe that the $1.3 million of cash donations is largely a flow through from our Master Fund Foundation class that I believe has roughly $27 million in it. That foundation class in our Master Fund, it pays fees, but the fees are 100% donated to the VGI Partners Foundation. And then the foundation in turn makes donations, and those donations go to a number of key charities. The key charities are listed on our website, but they're typically focused on assisting key charities that we believe support the families of first responders, military veterans, the Jewish community, and a number of other extremely worthy causes, including previously Sydney Children's Hospital. I don't know if you have anything else to add on that, Ian.
Thanks, Rob. Just the only other point to note is that VGI also manages about $38 million in FUM in its two unlisted vehicles for certain foundations pro bono. Management fees and performance fees for these foundations are rebated back to the client as additional units. Note that the $22 million in management fees in the half report are net of these amounts.
And the second half of that question is just around the cash balance and the expectations for that.
Well, the cash balance is a valuable asset of the company. We have utilised some of that cash balance over the past, for the first half of the year from January to June 30, and even more recently you'll see to make purchases in VG1 and VG8 when they've traded at a meaningful discount to NTA, and at this stage that cash is strategic and is earmarked for the opportunity to either seed or fund additional funds in the future to assist a new business unit and or other strategic purposes that the company may come across and agree to by the board of directors.
Can you please discuss the movements in fund withdrawals and inputs for your master fund, offshore fund, and individually managed accounts?
I'm happy to provide some detail. We've had relatively modest movements in the master fund, roughly in the quarter, we've had a relatively immaterial movement in the Australian dollar fund. It was roughly about $5 million. In the US dollar fund, it was about $18 million US dollars. I'm not sure whether those numbers are gross or net. Is that a gross number or a net number, Ian?
That is gross.
Okay, so it's a gross number. And then I would say that a majority of that in the Aussie dollar fund was completely offset with pre-existing clients who wanted to add to the Aussie dollar fund. So there would have been net inflow to the Aussie dollar fund. And I believe there was some modest inflow into the US dollar fund, but there would have been net outflow of the US dollar fund. But it's relatively modest, and I would say is fair to say immaterial relative to the size of the US dollar fund. So net. To answer the question, net inflow into the Aussie dollar fund, and modest or immaterial net outflow of the US dollar fund.
The next question here is, what changes to your analysis has occurred and what is the rationale for those changes?
Well, I think I've touched on that already. I don't think I'll go over that one again, but if you'd like more clarification, please call Ingrid Grower and we'll go through it.
And a follow-up question from the same person is, can you give specifics with regards to those industries that are on watch, which you mentioned earlier?
Look, I'd prefer not to go into the detail of what we're looking at. We'll talk about it in our investor letter. I don't know if you disagree with that.
No, that's good. We should take a phone question, Tom.
Yeah, operator, can we take the question from the phone lines, please?
Thank you. The phone question comes from Frederick Blanker from Bell Potter. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just a quick question for Rob. Would you say your focus, we lost a bit of focus with all the LICs, with all the roadshows, seems to have other funds, and what have you done now to get the focus back on investing? And then the other question, leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay. I wouldn't say it was a loss of focus. I just say it was a time allocation. We were watching our portfolio and doing work while we're on the road. Was it the same as being in the office? No. Is that a contributing factor to what's transpired over the June quarter? No, not at all, actually. What's transpired over the June quarter is the consequence of being in a position where we were conservatively placed, certainly over the second half of 2019. I think in our call earlier in the year, we had people asking us why we held cash and why we weren't that invested, and certainly in the Asian fund, because of, and then I think we talked about in the Asian fund the issues with the trade wars and a variety of other concerns in the area and valuations that were very high, with similar concerns in the US. Lo and behold, a trigger event happened. We certainly had no idea what was going to come, but there was vulnerability in the marketplace, and the US Federal Reserve was slowly increasing interest rates, if anyone can recall. And we were in a position, in a favourable position, going into March. Obviously, we had some stock holdings that weren't ideal, namely Wells Fargo and GE with its duopoly in jet engine manufacture and maintenance. But we had US dollar cash. We had a very good short book, and we had some robust positions, long investments that weathered the storm well. The issue wasn't the distraction of the roadshows or the VG8 raising last year. The issue was the fact that we did not take advantage of the weakness in the Australian dollar to any meaningful extent. We sold some of our US dollars, but only a very small amount. We made an error there, and we covered shorts, but as the market rallied, put more shorts on, and we sold one of our largest investments that we've owned since the IPO and owned for the last couple of years. We sold one of our top five positions, which was in Spotify, and that stock position, after we sold it, then went up nearly 120%. So any one of those errors, if you take out, we would have had a positive return. You take two of those errors out, and we have a mid-teens return. Without those three errors, I think we would have been up 25 or 30%. So I think actually more. So that's the situation. We made, having been in a very favourable position in March and largely preserving capital, and that we were up in March, our US dollar funds were modestly down, certainly nowhere near what the market was. Having been in that position, we thought that we were going to see an economic and financial marketplace environment that was going to be weak for a much longer period, and we got it. We misread the macro, and we misread the market signals. And so, thanks to your question, Freddie, but that's really the underlying driver. And the changes to the analysis and research process are not due to those three errors. The change in the research process is due to the fact that, things like what have transpired, gives you the ability to reinvent yourself and reassess. And, we've always been in a journey of continuous improvement. And I think, the events that have taken place, certainly over the course of this year, have not only been tremendously humbling, but they have been cathartic in nature for the organisation, and certainly personally have been a very, it's been a time for a lot of reflection and time for a lot of soul searching, and it's translated into a variety of modifications and a variety of changes that have been made, and hopefully will continue to be made.
Right, we've got another question on the webcast. It was reported in the newspaper that Joe Hockey joined VGI. What is his role and how does he add investing value to the team?
Okay. The Honourable Joe Hockey, or Ambassador Hockey, has joined our advisory board, and he's a special advisor to VGI. And he not only was the Treasurer of Australia, as I'm sure everyone's aware, but he was up until recently the Australian ambassador to the United States of America, and was an extremely well-regarded ambassador on both sides of the Strait of Washington, and certainly very much admired by the current administration. He provides substantial value in terms of strategic insight, and it's just one of a number of specialist advisors that VGI has access to. And I would say that it assists more with trying to get a better understanding of geopolitical risk and trying to get a better understanding of the future political landscape, which is becoming more and more intertwined with financial markets, and he's a very wise counsel, and we're very fortunate to have him as a special advisor.
Might go back to the line, but I think Freddie's got a follow-up question.
It's to do with VGH and the LICs. I think it's greatly buying things at a discount. My sort of view is to get the demand up for these things is to get out on the road and get planners to hear about it. But naturally, you're going to take bump, as you earlier didn't want to answer what you're doing in the future. It makes it very hard for financial planners and so on to sort of sell your funds to the client. I was wondering if you've got any view on changing that, because I just do not see that discount closing otherwise.
Not sure I understood.
I didn't quite understand the question. Freddie, I think that... David Simons here. I think we just missed the key point as to why you think that we're going to struggle to close the discount.
It's just bad reception here. Basically, because I think you need inherent demand for the LIC, and that comes from the financial planners selling it to their clients. And you're quite opaque with what you say and what your views are. You don't do much newsletters. It doesn't give much information for people to sell your funds, which was evident in the question earlier when someone asked, what's the future, what are you looking at? Which makes it, I think you just need demand for it, for the product. And that way the discount will close. So I was just wondering if you're going to try to do that, something to address that?
Yes, Freddie, I'll give you just a couple of thoughts there. It's David Simons again. Look, we actually announced last week that we are going to be revamping the way in which we present our monthly net tangible asset statements. So we recognise that the style that we have adopted until now has been to give planners less real insight into our holdings than many other funds managers do. And so you will see real change starting next month. We are also going to be doing a lot more video presentation material and portfolio update webcasts. Once again, responding to feedback which we have received. It will obviously be a gradual process. We need to make sure that we are harnessing our key people internally in a way which keeps them focused on their day job whilst also providing VGA financial planners with what they are looking for. But we would hope that if we combine better investor comms with proving the strategy over a period of time, recognising that this is a very new strategy which was launched last year, that over time we can be successful in closing that discount.
Great, we've got another question on the webcast. How do you adapt your investment process with companies like Pinterest with their material annual share-based remuneration costs? Do your intrinsic value estimates have any regard to the adjusted EBITDA numbers presented by these companies? Given investors are in aggregate happy to model based on these numbers, do they feature into your thinking around terminal value multiples or any other part of your process?
Okay, all right. Well, that's a very technical question asked by an equity analyst who's, you know, one of the better equity analysts in the country. In case most people are a little bit confused by the detail in that question, it's effectively saying that you have a company that largely was loss-making. It's now becoming profitable because it adds back stock option cost or compensation, which some companies add back, and US technology companies, a number of US companies have been doing now for a very long period of time, in fact for more than 20 years. Is it something that we take into account? Of course we do. We take into account the cost of stock options, we take into account the cost of dilution. It's a real cost to shareholders. Just like VGI Partners has options on issue to executives, that dilution is something that will take place in the future, and it's something investors need to be mindful of. So we obviously, as investors, take that into account. Do we think about the adjusted numbers for these types of businesses? Of course. And how do we value these kinds of companies? Well, this is a sort of similar question. I think when we bought Amazon about 5-6 years ago, it was about $270, $280. It was a loss-making company. It was deemed to be a loss-making company really for a very long period of time, in fact, indefinitely. Traditional approaches didn't make sense, and traditional approaches also don't make sense. Now you need to look at each investment opportunity for what it is. Again, to use the property analogy, it's a bit like being trained to value property that is in situ. Someone who's a trained valuer of blocks of apartments, maybe their skill set can't be, or they're not equipped to go and value blank pieces of land and see the development opportunity. And that's perhaps the difference between a valuer and a developer. And the same, I guess, goes in equity markets or in private equity or VC. Sometimes people can see things perhaps a little bit differently or take a different approach. and not everything has the same solution. And I think with Amazon, we showed that we can look outside of the square. You know, with the benefit of hindsight, there have been a few other things where we've got very close and we've moved on, or we've bought a position and we've bluffed ourselves out. You know, we bought a position in Apple at $80, $90 a share. We got bluffed out of it at $100 or $120 a share, which I'm sure is making some people, you know, shift in their seats at the moment. You know, we bought a position in Twitter at very low prices and got bluffed out. And as you can see, most recently, we made the classic error with Spotify. So what we need to do is ensure that we modify our investment styles and approach based on the situation. You know, to a man with a hammer, every problem is a nail, you know, is the saying, and we can't just use PEs or EV to EBITDAs or free cash flow metrics. Otherwise, you end up like the property investor who just uses cap rates and occupancy and, you know, he looks at a whale and misses the empty piece of land with the harbourside view. We just need to be very mindful that we adjust our techniques and stay open-minded and, you know, be very mindful of the price we pay and the value we get. And in the case of Pinterest, we've disclosed it as a top five position. Its market cap now, in fact EV, because it's got surplus cash, is in the low $20 billion range. Its current run rate of revenue is tracking to about $1.5 billion in a world where its MAUs are currently tracking monthly average users, since I hate using acronyms, everyone uses it, I won't try not to use it, but their monthly average users, Tom, is tracking roughly where at?
420 million
and globally utilised and growing at a rapid rate. It is a leader in its space. Facebook was in the space and decided it can't compete with Pinterest. It is the leader in visual search, and we think it will be a key player in that medium. And we think that it will be one of the apps that is a have to have and a must install on your phone. And it increasingly is on well over half a billion, you know, people's devices globally and growing at a rapid rate.
We have another question on the webcast.
Okay.
It seems unusual for a funds management group to have little scope to grow FUM through inflows. Given the closed-end nature of the bulk of FUM, how do you think about this? Are there plans to launch new strategies, or are these really contingent on reducing the discount to NTA on the existing LICs?
When we launched VG1 for the first 18 months, possibly longer, I think it was 18 months or maybe 18 months. VG1 traded at a premium that averaged
around 5%.
Around a 5% premium. I think it got up to a mid-teens premium at one point. If our two listed investment companies, but primarily VG1, as it's a global strategy, the only way to access our Asian strategy is through VGA. But when those two strategies are trading at NTA or preferably a modest premium, that is something that you know, we can then reassess in terms of a new strategy. We purposely closed our global funds to new investors as part of the VG1 fundraise, and that was to ensure that if people wanted to invest in our global strategy, that they could do so through VG1. Now, we have had previous or queued up investors who over the March quarter and the June quarter invested, took up their capacity in the master fund, but some of those took up some of their capacity, but in fact were buyers of VG1 shares on market. And we have a number of buyers of VG1 shares who have decided to buy effectively the same portfolio, not effectively, the same portfolio managed exactly the same way, not at NTA where they pay actually a buy spread, and the buy spread is currently 1.5%, I believe. Ian, you're shaking your head, not sure. But the buy spread is roughly in that vicinity. So if for every dollar you invest in our fund, there's a buy spread. So every dollar is roughly 98 and a half cents or thereabouts. We can confirm that number with Ingrid. And you can buy the same portfolio today at roughly a 20% discount in the market. So clearly a number of our investors have worked that out, and they are buying VG1 shares on market.
25 bips.
Sorry, 25-bit buy spread. I've got it completely wrong.
99
yeah, cents. Okay, well, there you go. Another, I'm making errors already. So that's the, yeah, so anyway, it's a different buy spread, but the point being is the discount. Instead of going in at roughly a dollar, or a dollar and not 99.75 cents, you are buying at a 20% discount. Are we looking at new strategies? At the moment, we're focused on restoring the discounts to NTA. We're focused on our two key portfolios, the global portfolio and the Asian portfolio. And we're focused, myself and the investment team are focused on positioning the portfolios for the environment that we're in and working on opportunities for the inevitable volatility that will come, and for the opportunities that we hope will ensue.
Great. I think that's all we have time for today. So thank you once again for your interest in VGI Partners and for joining the call. If you have any questions that we didn't address, please contact Ingrid Groer and we'd be happy to discuss offline.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.